Dan, there seems to be seats over here if you'd be interested in them. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Patricia Dart, and I represent Richard Tyson, the appellant, in this matter. I would like to preserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
The issue before the court is whether the trial court erred when it held that Mr. Tyson bore the burden of proof to establish that he met the criteria for conditional release under Section 37.2912, which is the sexually violent predator proceeding. It's a statutory construction issue, and the relevant cases are Cloud, Bell, and Gibson. In the Gibson case, which was just decided in April of 2014, this court reiterated its holding in McLeod, removing any doubt that in a sexually violent predator proceeding.
Counsel, was there an objection in the trial court to this burden of proof issue?
Your Honor, the judge actually never came out and ruled that Mr. Tyson had the burden until the order was issued in March of 2014. But Mr. Tyson did request a conditional release hearing.
Was there ever an argument made in the trial court on the burden proof issue?
By Mr. Tyson? No.
It seems to me that as a result of that exchange, that you may be correct that there was an error, but the real issue is it preserved? And the secondary issue is, even if it is not preserved, does it merit consideration under the ends of justice exception? Perhaps you'd like to move to those questions.
Well, Your Honor, in a sexually violent predator proceeding, as in a criminal matter, the loss of liberty is at stake, and so therefore it's there are dire consequences. Grave injustices may be done if the end of justice is not invoked in these proceedings.
Well, grave injustice may be done. The question is, has it been done?
Your Honor, I believe that the engraved injustice is that Mr. Tyson was committed without the benefit of having sufficient evidence to have him committed. He did not have a due process of law because the burden of proof was erroneously allocated to him. So that's the injustice. Had the court continued the matter for a conditional release hearing, then the burden of proof issue would have been decided in the Gibson matter.
But both sides decided to proceed without that. There wasn't any objection to proceeding on the evidence that had already been presented.
Your Honor, in requesting that there was Mr. Tyson be allowed to have a conditional release hearing, to me that implies that the Commonwealth has the burden to show that there is no less restrictive alternative to commitment.
Well, that's true, but the question at this point is that nobody objected to proceeding on the evidence that had already been heard. And without an objection on that ground, what we have is a record that has evidence. For the sake of argument, I will agree with you that the trial court erred on the burden. There isn't an objection to anything. And as a result, it seems to me, and you correct me if you think I'm wrong, but it seems to me the only issue before us now is whether or not the ends of justice exception to the finality rule of 525 applied in this case, not in a vacuum, not as a generality, but in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I think it does because the court's ruling was in error.
Can I interrupt you there? I don't understand that. If if 525 is inapplicable when you have a winning argument, if the ends of justice exception kicks in whenever you have a winning argument, and you said the trial court's in error, so you have a winning argument, you say, doesn't that mean logically that there's no such thing as procedural default, that we're all just using semantics that doesn't apply to anything, because the only thing you can waive is a losing argument? Well, that doesn't add a lot.
But in this particular case, it involved the deprivation of freedom.
Well, every criminal case arguably involves that. But my point is that if simply saying, I have a winner argument, is enough to fit within the ends of justice, then unless I'm making some very obvious logical error, the only thing you can waive is something that you don't need to waive because you're going to lose anyway. Which I think the final conclusion would be, therefore, there is no Rule 525. Because you can only waive things that are losers. You can't waive things that are winners.
But in this case, it involves this court reversing itself to the extent that Bell was contrary to McLeod. In other cases where the ends of justice may not have been applied, it involved the court disagreeing with prior interpretation of the statute, whereas here the court clearly said that to the extent that Bell was contrary to previous holdings, that
right, but
it overruled.
The attorney in Gibson didn't have a problem saying that. Didn't have a problem saying your case law is wrong and I want you to reconsider it. And that's exactly the job of an advocate to do that when it's the position of the client. You heard from a prior argument that some of our case law is ambiguous on subjects. We expect litigants and lawyers to tell us that and to argue that we're wrong when we are wrong. But if we say, no, you never have to do that, and if we change our minds later, we'll bail you out. Is that what procedural default law is meant to do?
No, Your Honor, but I believe that when you're dealing with a material part of a proceeding, such as burden of proof, that when an error is made on that issue, that the ends of justice should apply. And I would just note that while this may be more of a sufficiency of the evidence argument, the fact that the burden was that the Commonwealth had to prove that there was no less restrictive alternative. And the evidence that was presented at the initial proceeding, in my mind, didn't rise to the level of a prima facie case that would then have
well,
Mr.
Well, let's
Tyson
go. Let's go there. Why don't we go there? That's a great segue. He was adjudicated a sexually violent predator, and there's no appeal of that adjudication, which means the only issue that remains is whether or not there is a criteria for conditional release nonetheless from custody. So that's the issue. We had the original hearing to determine whether he was a sexually violent predator. Nobody objected at that point to deciding the second question, the conditional release, based on the evidence that had already been presented in the adjudication that preceded it. And that's what the record shows. I think you'd agree with that.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, well, we have, as Justice Kelsey has pointed out, we have what may be an error, and for the sake of argument, we'll concede for the argument's sake that it was, but no objection. So now the court's decision not to permit conditional release actually plays into the question of whether or not there's a manifest injustice in this case. And the evidence in the adjudication phase in this case was that this man, who happened to be a piano teacher, had raped a 12-year-old piano student, that he had not complied with the conditions of his treatment plan, because one of the things he was supposed to do was to refrain from having what I think in the world of counseling is called triggers. And he secreted pictures of young girls all through things in his room and violated the plan. The testimony was that it supported the view that he was actually a public safety risk and was not cooperative with the plan that was already there. If we look at that evidence in that light, what is a grave injustice? What is the injustice about his custody?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the evidence was that he had some infractions involving contraband, and those infractions, the latest infraction was in 2010. This hearing was in 2014. Mr. Tyson put on evidence from his case manager that indicated that he had an annual review in 2013 and that his behavior was good because he didn't lose any good time. The court could consider the evidence that was presented through the two experts as far as the risk factor, which is the static 99 and the static 99R, that where he scored on an average with the average sex offender. He scored a 3 on the 99 and a 2 on the static 99R, which the experts indicated that was the same as an average sex offender. And then Dr. Noblick opined that given the static and the dynamic risk factors, that Mr. Tyson's risk was at the very least moderate, probably quite higher. Dr. Miller indicated that Mr. Tyson's risk to reoffend was high, but it still doesn't go to the treatment. There was no evidence as to the treatment that pertained to Mr. Tyson in particular. Those experts talked about treatment in a general sense, and in fact, Dr. Noblick indicated that the evaluation that she did of Mr. Tyson the purpose was not to address a treatment, but the purpose was to answer a legal question. And so, therefore, given what was presented at the initial stage, and I will remind the court that the Commonwealth had filed a motion in limine to make sure that the very things that the court needed to consider on the issue of whether to commit or conditionally release should not be presented to the jury, because that was not relevant to whether or not Mr. Tyson was a sexually violent predator. So given that...
But that would have been presented in a subsequent hearing on the status of his custody, but nobody objected to proceeding on the prior evidence.
But, Your Honor, I would
It's hard to complain about that when nobody took advantage of the bifurcated proceeding.
Well, Mr. Tyson asked for the bifurcated proceeding, and the judge did not grant that request. And he still, even though he has the right to either commit or continue the hearing, he has the discretion to commit or continue the hearing, he still has to consider the factors that are presented in 912. And there's no evidence that he did that. And that's a grave injustice to Mr. Tyson.
Counsel, your client's hearing was February 25th, 2015, or February 25th, 2014, I guess, with the rehearing on the 25th of February. What's his current status?
He's incarcerated. He's not had an annual review.
He has not had his annual review?
No, Your Honor.
But I understand that it was scheduled and it was continued until August.
Well, we thought it was scheduled, but it turned out the court didn't have it on its docket, so it was continued to August because Mr. Tyson has requested an expert to help in his defense. But I will say that it turned out it was on the docket.
What would be the right answer if there had been an objection at some point, exactly at the right moment, where you say, Your Honor, you know, I realize that Bell is on point, although it is dicta. It was dicta, and that's how we didn't overrule it. We said it was dicta and didn't follow it, which is an important distinction. Nonetheless, suppose the attorney said, you know, there is dicta, I admit it, saying the burden of proof is on me, but I think that's wrong, and I'd like to challenge you. And I think the burden of proof is on the Commonwealth. Is it possible the trial court could have said, I just sat through all the evidence. It doesn't matter to me who has the burden of proof. I'm not granting this rapist conditional release. I've heard the evidence. That's my ruling. Is that a very is that a possible hypothetical?
Almost, if you read the comments of the judge, the trial judge, it's about what took place. He didn't say.
Well, isn't that a very good reason why isn't that a very good reason why trial courts should be informed of all the legal issues that we're asked to decide, so that they can, if there's a way to point out that this case is not the case for it, they can address it, because that one remark would have ended this case.
And that is problematic on my part, but I feel as though when you're talking about the loss of somebody's liberty, that a technicality such as that should not prevent this court from remanding this case, when clearly there was an error on the part of the judge, and the judge. I noticed that my time
you may,
is
you matched. May answer the question.
Thank you. That the judge never did address that issue, only in his order. And the court, as this court knows, the court speaks through its orders. And it was then that he allocated the burden of proof to Mr. Tyson. And I noted my objection on behalf of Mr. Tyson, and I did add the language for the reasons stated on the record. But throughout that proceeding, you know, I had asked for jury instructions that would instruct the jury that Mr. Tyson had no obligation to present any evidence, that the burden is on the Commonwealth. And so I would ask the court to reverse the trial court's decision and remand this so that Mr. Tyson can have his conditional release hearing that he's entitled to.
All right. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Jill Ryan, and I'm representing the Commonwealth in this matter. This appeal, the sexually violent predator case. Again, as the court knows, this appeal arises out of the 2014 trial where Mr. Tyson was found by a jury by clear and convincing evidence to be a sexually violent predator. And at the conclusion of that trial, the trial court asked the Commonwealth what, if any, evidence it wanted to present. And at that point, the Commonwealth, relying on the apparent controlling authority of Commonwealth v. Bill, advised the court that it was the respondent's burden to prove that he met the criteria for conditional release, but also pointed out to the court the operation of 37.2-908 subsection D, which at that point the trial court is either to decide to civilly commit the respondent or continue the matter for the preparation of a conditional release plan, and advocated for the court, based on all of the evidence adduced at trial, to go ahead and civilly commit Mr. Tyson as a sexually violent predator. At that point in time, Mr. Tyson, when asked by the trial court, Mr. Tyson simply advocated for a continuance to have the opportunity to present a conditional release plan. As the record states and as the appendix is clear, Judge Ford went through a number of factors, delineating a great deal of evidence on why he felt that Mr. Tyson was not appropriate for conditional release, why he did not meet those factors and ordered him to be civilly committed.
Counsel, on the least restrictive alternative issue,
yes.
It looks like the judge also said that the reason he wouldn't consider a less restrictive alternative was because the offense had been committed when family support and other kinds of less restrictive situations had been in place. Isn't that right?
That's correct. And what the trial judge, I believe, was referring to, and this was some of the testimony we adduced at trial, was there are a certain number of risk factors for sex offenders, and a great deal of which, many of which Mr. Tyson had. There are also protective factors that could lessen an offender's risk, and some of those protective or positive factors we also drew out, but made the point that those were in place already when Mr. Tyson raped his 12-year-old piano student. So to look ahead to try and decide whether there was a viable plan in the community in terms of employment, in terms of family support, in terms of independent living. I believe that what the trial court was saying is we've already heard that those were in place before, and that did not stop him from offending, coupled with then his behavior in Department of Corrections, where he continually attempted to obtain pictures and secrete pictures of young girls consistent with his victim pool. So we believe certainly, not that sufficiency is before the court today, but certainly there was a wealth of evidence before the court as to why Mr. Tyson did not meet all of those factors that he needs to meet in order to be safely conditionally released to the community. And as the Commonwealth noted in its...
sufficiency is an issue, as the Chief Justice said, with regard to the ends of justice analysis, isn't it?
It would be in terms of the second prong of the ends of justice analysis. First, whether or not there was an error. And I guess sufficiency can be mixed in sort of in the idea of whether there was a grave injustice or a manifest injustice. And for all of those reasons, for the fact that we had two experts explaining that Mr. Tyson had a sexual deviance for pubescent females, that he also had a personality disorder, that while the actuarial scores, as Ms. Dart mentioned, may have been average, all of his dynamic risk factors placed him at a significant risk or a high risk. The fact that Mr. Tyson had been accused, although acquitted, of a prior rape of another piano student, but the circumstances after that, the adverse consequences, after which he places himself again in the company of young girls, leading to this rape. So that mindset, that choice, and certainly while he's in the Department of Corrections, while he's in sex offender treatment in the Department of Corrections, and even after being sanctioned for trying to obtain materials regarding young girls, again, consistent with his deviant interest, in contravention of his treatment plan, he repeats that behavior. One of the things mentioned was there wasn't an infraction since 2010, but the record is clear from the testimony that Mr. Tyson kept engaging in that behavior. It wasn't written up in the Department of Corrections as an infraction, but it was repeatedly addressed through his treatment plan at the sex offender residential treatment program.
The very fact that we're having this discussion, tell me if I'm missing something. Doesn't that make ends of justice outcome determinative? Because if we were to say, for example, the evidence is overwhelming, it's harmless error if there's error at all, he clearly was not entitled to his conditional release on any basis. If we were to say that, we could only say that having first found the ends of justice, the ultimate goal of justice, has been breached. How is that even consistent? Wouldn't we, by making the very holding that there was no injustice at all, much less the very telos of injustice, haven't we said two diametrically opposed things through the same judicial mouth? And doesn't that mean that if our legal analysis gives us that result, we must be doing something wrong analytically?
I'm not sure I'm following your question, so I apologize.
It seems as though you can only, under the approach that is argued in this court every session, you can only procedurally waive losing arguments. Therefore, you cannot procedurally waive a winning argument. Therefore, there's no such thing as a real procedural default.
Well, in terms of ends of justice, of course, this court has applied it. But I would say the cases where it's been applied, they're sort of facially egregious. The conviction of a non-offense, or not only the Commonwealth not proving an element of the offense, but then the jury being erroneously instructed as to that. And what I would say in this matter, while burden of proof is obviously important, there's an argument that the trial court didn't even err in light of the language in Bell, the language that we brought to the court's attention, the language which was not challenged by Mr. Tyson. But if it turns out that somehow the court should have known that that burden was wrong, despite no one bringing it to its attention, then that's the second problem, is was there a grave injustice as a result? And in cases where this court has applied the ends of justice, that's sort of where the rubber hits the road. What is that grave injustice? And it is a high bar, and this court has said we're only going to apply it in extreme cases because we can procedurally default constitutional claims, for example. It's been applied in death penalty cases. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not, but I don't believe, while not trivializing what the burden of proof is, that this case arises to that grave injustice and the showing of that actual prejudice, or actual injustice in this case, especially without a whisper of preservation. The court gave Mr. Tyson the opportunity to discuss the burden of proof, discuss any evidence wanted to present, and they simply asked for continuance, which is allowed under the statute, but the court declined that. There was suggestion in the reply brief and again in oral argument that because Mr. Tyson had asked for a jury instruction on not having to produce evidence before the jury, that that somehow preserved the later burden of proof at the disposition phase, which we would argue, first of all, that's not what was alleged in the brief as a preservation, but secondly, that's a strained interpretation for the reason stated on the record, because again, when presented with this is what the Commonwealth says the burden is, this is the authority the Commonwealth is using, Mr. Tyson remained silent on that. And then finally, the fact that while burden of proof is important, Mr. Tyson still had that burden to bring that to the court's attention, and the fact that it seemed futile is not an excuse. As was noted, counsel for Mr. Gibson made that argument. He made that argument successfully. And yes, now we're in a different place where we are all aware clearly of who has the burden of proof.
It wasn't futile anyway. It was dicta. There's no futility in challenging dicta. We distinguish dicta almost every session.
That's true, Your Honor. But again, without making that argument to the court as to the trial court, as to why Bell does not apply.
What I mean is it's not even perceived futility at all. To say that, well, there's a dicta statement out there, so I'm not going to make any argument whatsoever on behalf of my client.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, that when Mr. Tyson was invited to say anything he wanted to about that, and remained silent on that issue, and instead now he's implicit in asking for a conditional release plan. So as we had stated in our brief, we don't feel that the trial court erred. But if the trial court did err under the ends of justice exception, it should not apply in this matter. And finally, there's no grave injustice, no manifest injustice when we look at what, similar to what we cited in the Georgia case, what the ultimate outcome would be when there wasn't even a sufficiency claim made, that the trial court was correct in its ultimate decision.
Ms. Ryan, the last session of the court, we had a sexually violent predator case on the docket, and we got to this point in the hearing, and as a result of a couple of questions, and I'm quick to say that you were not the Assistant Attorney General in the case. I'm going to make that clear as I ask you this question. The next hearing was looming large on the horizon, and it was only then that we found out that the Commonwealth had reached an agreement on the disposition which mooted the entire question. And I can tell you, I was not happy with that, and neither were my colleagues. Can we be assured that no such arrangement is extant in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. I would tell the court that we had the annual review scheduled. I'm not sure what happened with the court's docket, but by the order. And we have no agreement at this point. As Ms. Dart said, there was a continuance in order for Mr. Tyson to get a second opinion evaluation. We do not have that evaluation to know what that expert's opinion even is. So we have, at this point, no agreement pending, just a court date pending on the issues of whether he remains a sexually violent predator.
Well, thank you for your argument. Call the next case.